I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
What is happening, everybody? It is the Wind Up Podcast. We are back, and we are in a different hotel room this time. The last time we chatted, we were out in Pittsburgh for a couple of wine events. I'm currently sitting in a glorious spot, Columbia, Missouri, for starting off another trip with just jam-packed events start to finish until the end of next week. It has been crazy. The last few weeks, we have missed out on recording proper episodes because it's just been one trip after another. And every little stop that I have at home to take, it's time to basically do some laundry, reset, get back out on the road all over again. So it has been a lot of fun. It has certainly been a little challenging at times, and we're just doing the best we can with it. I finally have about an extra hour or so to kill in the hotel room. So with that, we are going to dive into our April question and answer episode. This is one I definitely didn't want to miss because it's something that realistically, they're most fun for me because I get to dive into kind of what folks are interested in, where folks want to have a conversation. It's definitely the most interactive of the episodes that we do. And for that reason, I wanted to carve out at least a half hour, hopefully here, where we could answer some of the questions that we're diving into. It's going to be a great one, especially after some of the travels that we've been on, some of the stories that we're going to get to tell, and some of kind of the perspective that hopefully I can give when it comes to the road warrior side of the wine industry. So before we get too much into it, couple of quick announcements. Again, thank you for all of you who we've seen on the road. We've been all over the Midwest, the East Coast, and to have folks walk up and be like, hey, we've really been enjoying the show. You know, keep it coming. You know, love to hear your perspective on everything. Not gonna lie, the compliments are great. I feel bad about this, you know, going a couple of weeks without being able to post anything. So I wanna thank you all for your patience. Please continue to rate, review, share the show with folks who you think might find it interesting. Again, if you write comments or share it with people or have the chance to do a little, you know, star review rating, whether that's on YouTube or on our actual, wherever you're consuming your podcasts, that is a huge help in terms of getting the show kind of out and about and working with the algorithms that are out there, right? Number two, we did just have a processing of a wine club that's going out. There are many of you that are in our MTGA wine club. You've likely received that shipment notification and tracking info. There are a few of you that I'm still following up with. Have no fear, you'll be hearing from me here shortly to make sure that we have everything dialed in. For those of you that want more information on that, you can head to our website, mtgawines.com, and click on the top nav there. You can find out all kinds of information about those wines and how they come your way eventually. Last but certainly not least, please make sure you're following us on all of our social networks. That's Instagram, The Book of Face, the social network formerly known as Twitter, and especially YouTube. On those four things, you're going to be able to find all kinds of content. In the next couple of weeks, once I'm finally back at home, we're going to be posting a whole bunch of information on new wines that we just released this month, tasting notes, cellar updates, all kind of the normal kind of fun things that are going on. If you really want that kind of great day-to-day, here's what actually is happening in a wine program. That's where you're gonna find all of our things. It's just at MTJ Wines on all any of those networks and you'll find us. All right, without further ado, I have my cup of crappy hotel coffee. So good. And we're gonna dive into some of these questions. First and foremost, we're going to dive into one here that is very pertinent to what's been going on. And that is as follows. Question number one, how is success measured on the road for wineries? You know what? This is something that is an interesting kind of point of contention for many wineries. Because a friend of mine, four friends of mine, there are four of us total. Sorry, my brain's a little scrambled. I don't know what time zone I'm in. Four of us decided, and this would have been sometime between 2016 and 18, and it was when we kind of saw a little downturn in terms of tourism and business to the Napa area. And being small brands that were, you know, family owned or owner operated like us, we were like, hey, how can we get out and share our wines with people? If they're not coming to Napa, can we go to them? And a few organizations had tried doing this previously. Many of them had failed miserably just because of, you know, inner politics and relationships and things. They were always kind of weird. And we were like, well, let's do this. Let's go ahead and travel with like just a group of us that we know we like being around each other. And if our respective businesses are okay with kind of how we want to organize this, more focused on kind of the people, the wines are great. We know that already. Let's focus on the people to make sure that we can really be successful as a group. And for us, that's really, I think, how we've been able to be successful now going on 6 or 8 years of doing this. But that's not really how we measure success. You know, it's one thing to go out on the road and see folks like yourselves who listen to the show, whether, I mean, so many of you were out in Chicago or Kansas City or St. Louis or back east when we were there. You know, it's great to see you guys. But for many wineries, including ourselves, we need to sell wine. You know, that is how we stay in business. That's how we pay the bills. And that is why we go on these trips. So for the vast majority of wineries, everyone kind of has their own calculation. And it comes down to just how much we're spending on that trip and how much wine are we selling. There are many that it's just a clear, simple, like P&L, like here's how successful this trip actually was. Now, I take a little bit of a different approach. And I think there are some wineries that do this, but there's kind of this little bit of friction with some at the moment. And it stems from the fact that these sales trips became so successful and so quickly that people were selling a bunch of wine. And, you know, some of my best friends and great colleagues, you know, their expectation is that when they come out to do an event, when they're on the road like this, sitting in a hotel room, that whatever they're doing that night or that afternoon, they're selling tens of thousands, at least like 10 grand, if not tens of thousands of dollars in wine. Like they're looking for these big splashes. And that's great. I mean, don't get me wrong. We will take it. You know, we do need to pay for this trip. You know, we do need to, you know, pay bills. We got to try to afford bottling and harvest and all these other things. We can't just be flying around the country giving away wine samples and time. There are a lot of us, and this is kind of where I differ, is one, I do want to sell a good chunk of wine, obviously, to kind of pay our way through this and also be able to afford the winemaking side of things. That is certainly a part of my calculation. But, you know, we're still a small growing brand, and I think this is where a lot of wineries kind of get lost in the weeds, is they're so focused on that, you know, short-term sale that they miss out on kind of the long-term relationship building by doing these events. And I'll give you an example of that. As I'm recording this, the HBIC, Brittany herself, is in Dallas for an event called Côte de Cour. It's a big heart health fundraiser that they put on, and something that we've never done before. This is our first time going out there. So while I'm on the road in Missouri, she is in Dallas knocking that out. We know we have a lot of friends. We have a lot of great clients and club members in Dallas. Many of them attended some of our events earlier in the week, and some of them are attending the main events today and on Saturday. Now, I'm not expecting this big splash of sales, and it's not because of a lack of trying or, you know, me not being there and Brittany being there instead. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with the fact that this is the first time we're doing this event. And there are going to be a lot of people there that we've never met. We'll have some common ground with some clients and some fans and club members. But because this is our first time there, it's likely going to be an event where we're shaking hands and kissing babies. Like we're just saying hey to people. We're getting to know people, both that are involved with that organization, those that attend this event regularly, and folks that come out to Napa but have never heard of us. So there are certain events and certain trips that, in essence, that's our marketing budget. We're saying, hey, we're not doing normal advertising. We're not doing ratings and reviews. We're not paying for social media consultants. We're not doing any of that stuff. what we'll do is we'll spend our money actually going out and getting in front of people so that they can get to know us. That way, when they want to come to Napa and make an appointment, they either text Brittany or I, call us, and we're like, hey, all right, let's go ahead and get you out to the winery. That way, you actually can put a face to the name and the brand and the wines and all of the things. That has been a super important sticking point for us in our brand strategy and our marketing strategy and how we conduct ourselves. So with that in mind, measuring success on the road can vary. I think far too many wineries do not focus enough on that relationship building, and far too many put too much weight on the sales side of things, the short-term gain instead of the long-term. You know, you got to do whatever ownership's going to ask of you, right? So there are going to be certain expectations that, hey, if you're going to go on the road, you better be selling a bunch of wine. And we've had folks, you know, in our own travel group, they're like, hey, this trip just wasn't as successful as ownership wanted. We won't be able to come back and do it again with you. We're like, all right, cool. No harm, no foul. You know, that's just kind of the way the cookie crumbles in the grand scheme of the wine business. And that's okay. For me, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I at least want to cover my costs. It would be lovely to sell a whole bunch of wine. But if it's a new event, a new market, new clients, and it's, we're going fishing, you know, we're casting a line and seeing how many bites we can get. And hopefully that pays off in the long run. Because, you know, I'll be honest, you know, we do not sell out of our wine at release. We have wine regularly available across a few different ones. There are some that do sell out immediately, but there's a lot that doesn't. So we still need to be marketing. We still need to be getting in front of people. We still have opportunities to sell. You know, if we sold out of our wine as soon as they released, if our wine club took every single last bottle of wine throughout the year, then this would be a different conversation. But because we're still a brand that is growing and we have wine to sell, it's far more important to get out there in front of people and get wine in people's glasses than it is to sit at home and wait for them to come to you or act as though you're this, you know, highfalutin allocation only brand, because it's just not true. And so many places have tried to do that and have failed miserably because they end up sitting on this inventory and just waiting for people to come to them. So measuring success goes a couple of different ways when it comes to these road trips. For us, it is one, selling wine, one B, you know, getting to know the people who are in our wine club and on our mailing list, and, you know, one C, capturing potential new customers, whether that's them signing up for a mailing list, maybe they want to order a little bit of wine and give it a try, and then building those relationships from there. That's really how I think wineries should be measuring their success on the road. Not everyone is going to see eye to eye on that. Many, many people focus on those sales first and foremost and say, hey, this is one ABC, and then everything else is like number 3, 4, 5 down the list. And it's a little bit more focused on the short term. You know, whether or not you agree with that, totally okay. Everyone's going to have their own kind of metrics for success when it comes to doing these road trips, which is interesting to say the least. All righty, question number 2. Oh, and this is actually kind of in relation to that. We have here, with a slower start to 2024 in terms of visitors, something that we've talked about on the show a couple of times, how are wineries impacted and what are they doing to adapt? Now, plain and simple, how they're impacted is visitation down and sales are down. For many places, including ourselves. You know, we're seeing far less people this year than we have last year, and even more so than the year before, in 2022. So, you know, that's tough. When you're a small, direct brand, like we are, you rely on visitation to a certain point. I mean, that typically for us, that makes up about a third, at least, if not more, of our overall sales throughout the year. So if we're not seeing that, what can we do to, you know, adapt? And a part of it are these road trips. It's why Brittany and I are on the road right now. It's why we're going to be on the road through most of May as well, and then even part of June, and likely a couple more trips in either July or August right before harvest kicks in, and then again in November. Like, we are going to be on the road a lot this year because the writing's on the wall. And similar to my answer on, you know, measuring success and how this travel kind of works, is that you can't just sit around and hope people find you and buy your wine. You know, hope is not what you pay bills with. You have to pay bills with dollars, as it turns out. And this is a conversation I have with many of our referral sources, you know, many people that are putting together these events, you know, when they're like, oh, this is a great marketing opportunity. It's putting you in front of people. And it's like, that's really nice, but I need to have a little bit more of a definite like ROI on some of these things. So, you know, for example, as we're adapting and planning some of these events, it's a very honest conversation with clients. It's like, hey, you know, I'm happy to come out and we're happy to do an event with you or, you know, be on the road and work with a distributor, but we need to be selling wine at a certain point. Like it is coming down to dollars and cents. You know, if we were having a, you know, more flush year, if we were selling more wine, then maybe we could be a little bit more flexible. But in these years where, you know, it's a little tighter, you have to buckle down and you have to find ways to move wine one way, shape, or form, which is why we've opened up new markets in terms of distribution. Typically something that we really haven't done, at least in about 5 or 6 years. So with that in mind, it's like, all right, let's throw this at the wall and see if it sticks. Let's try something new. For us, it's signing up with the Napa Valley Vintners, kind of the marketing agency, you know, within Napa, and using some of their resources for, you know, direct sales and distribution and things of that nature. You know, we're spending some money to try and make more and be more stable as a business. And it's, you just kind of have to throw stuff at the wall. The amount of brands that kind of sit there and they're like, oh, well, you know, it's fine. We'll just ride this out, end up being in a lot of trouble. Even if they've been really, really popular and really, really successful in recent years, if you rest on your laurels in any way, shape, or form, it's a recipe for disaster. If we happen to have, I mean, let's just say hypothetically that this year, you know, stays relatively slow, and then 2025 is relatively slow. Now you've had a couple, you've basically going on 2.5 to 3 years of kind of a downturn in business when it comes to visitation to the Napa Valley, and you're a direct wine business, you're going to be feeling it really, really hard if you're not already. And some of us have been lucky enough where we've been able to ride this wave. We're still doing all right. You know, I was talking to somebody about kind of surrounding some of the sponsorships within Festival Napa Valley this summer. And she is the head of marketing and communications. I can't remember for what brand, but we ran into each other just having dinner just at the bar at Market in St. Helena. And she had the best turn of phrase for it. That right now, a even year is an up year, where, yeah, you're not seeing any growth, but you didn't lose anything, and that's fine. Like, that's okay. If you've hit a plateau and you can ride it out there, that's great. If you're seeing a big drop and downturn, you're really getting into some, you know, treacherous waters there. And of course, if you're growing in these down years, then hey, you're killing it. You're doing something that no one else is doing, basically. So with the slower starts to years like this, with 2023, even last year being slower than what 2022 or and especially what 21 had to offer, you got to start throwing stuff at the wall. You got to start trying new things. You got to be creative and you have to start getting out there. You got to start pounding the pavement and doing some work. If you're going to sit around and just wait for stuff to come to you, I hope you can pay your bills with hope. That's all I can say, because my credit card companies don't accept hope as currency. Maybe yours do. I don't know. Okay. Question number 3. Oh, another good one, considering kind of what we've been talking about after the 2023 season. After a big harvest season, how does that impact future years and harvests? This is where you get into kind of the long-term planning and game and kind of gaming your system of what you look for. Now, with so much wine being made in 2023 because of bigger yields and specifically bigger like juice yields, I mean, we don't have an empty barrel in the cellar right now. Everything is full. You're gonna have a lot of wine and you have many options to, you know, sell said wine. A lot of folks are dumping it onto the bulk market. It's pre-made wine so that other folks can snatch that up and blend a wine and kind of make a white label brand that they didn't quote unquote make, but they blended and are now selling under XYZ label. You see that a lot, and it's a man, that juice is really, really cheap right now because the market is flooded. It's pretty easy to find a high quality wine that's kind of pre-made for you right now. You maybe bottle it up under your own label, but if you see a huge increase, like do you actually have enough of a burn rate in terms of selling wine to your clientele, whether it's distribution or wine club or whatever, can you actually move through that amount of inventory, you know, effectively? Or are you going to end up with hundreds or thousands of cases stuck in warehouses because you can't move it? That could cause a huge problem when you have a big glut like this. So on the business and kind of wine sales side of things, there are a lot of wineries kind of figuring out, like, what do we do with all this extra juice? The bulk market is so, you know, inundated right now that we can't get a good price for this. You know, we're going to lose money if we try and sell this on the bulk market because it's just flooded with gallonage right now. Maybe you don't necessarily have the capital to be able to bottle up all this additional juice. And maybe you don't have that burn rate. You don't have a sales channel in which you can kind of push that extra wine that you're making. So there are a few, I'm sure there are wineries that are kind of stuck between this rock and a hard place. You know, this is something that we're contending with as well. It's like, well, we've already opted not to sell any of our juice on the bulk market because we would lose money on it, plain and simple. So we're already taking a loss there. We're very luckily enough opening up different sales channels, you know, through distribution where we think we could probably have some success in making different wines through our second labels. That could work. So, you know, we're throwing some stuff at the wall and seeing if it sticks. What's going to be more interesting, because we talked about this in a few episodes of just cost of grapes, is that you're seeing the Napa grape market and grape markets kind of around California kind of slow to a halt. You know, there's so much fruit available right now because of this bumper crop year that we had last year that you're going to see, I think, if we have another year, if this year's another big yielding year, you're going to start to see a little bit of a reset of the grape market. It'll come back to a little bit more of an equilibrium. I mentioned in a couple episodes ago that, you know, the price for Napa Cabernet in the last 3-4 years has increased 40%. Per ton. It's been an outrageous rise in cost for grapes because it's been in high demand, and we had a very low yielding year in 2020 because of the fires. People trying to make up ground in 21 and 22, and you just saw it skyrocket in terms of, you know, pricing for Napa Cabernet, and other varieties, of course, were affected as well. You're going to start to see that level out, I think. It's my hope. Anyway, because I'm of the opinion, and I love our growers, they're great folks to work with. There are plenty in and around Napa, Sonoma, and other regions that have had us winemakers buy the balls, you know, and we have no choice but to pay what they're asking, because if we don't, someone else will. So we've had to absorb this crazy increase in costs almost no matter what, because what are we going to do? You know, we're literally stuck between this rock and a hard place. And I think after this year, you know, after this last year and going into this year, we, the winemakers and vineyards, are starting to have a little bit more of negotiating power, which is nice to see. I think this is something that the industry has needed. I'm a huge proponent that, you know, there are many growers and some producers that are skewing this average pricing to the nth degree. And it's really having a negative impact on the entire grape market. That is something that has been a huge problem, and this is something that needs to be fixed. And I think these big years where there's going to be a lot of fruit available is going to do just that. It's not necessarily going to be a huge like reset or anything like that, but you're going to see it start to come to some sort of equilibrium. And I think that is something that's very, very important. Whether or not this continues into future years, we'll see. But at least for this year, we're seeing the effects of this really big harvest and a lot of juice available. And hopefully it's going to allow for producers like ourselves to find great fruit at a great price and be able to make excellent wine and not have to take the price increases that we've had to take over the last 4 years. I personally don't like doing that. I don't think that that's something I want to do. But when your cost is, you know, increasing by 40% or 30% or whatever that percentage is, that has to get absorbed somewhere. You know, we can't just, you know, keep a status quo in terms of pricing. No business can. So you have to, you know, look long and hard at kind of what you're spending and figure out where those increases are going to come. You know, we've been very, you know, for us, we've been very, very conservative in our price increases, maybe, you know, a 10% increase at most here or there for some of our wines. So we've been able to absorb a lot of this increased cost. It means our margins are not quite as good. But we also know, you know, based on the wines we make and, you know, kind of where they're at, you know, we can't ask someone to pay 40% more, you know, if that happened to be the average increase across, you know, all facets of our COGS. You know, that was something that I don't think that our business could absorb. So it was kind of banking on, hey, this is going to come to some sort of equilibrium. You know, costs are going to go up, but hopefully it kind of backs off a little bit in future years. That's definitely where I hung my hat. So far, so good. We'll see if that actually continues in years down the road. Okay. Last but certainly not least, I saved this one for last because this is one that I think is going to, this is an interesting one that we're going to get into. So some of you who follow us on the Instagram and the Book of Face saw a social media post of mine at some point in the last week that was in reference to a substance that is used in winemaking that winemakers and vineyards do not have to label that they use it. It was really funny kind of posting it because there were a bunch of people within the industry who jumped into our DMs and were like, is this what you're talking about? Or there were some that are like, oh, I got that email too. This is totally crazy. And I'm just going to go out and say it. So that way some of you, if you're so interested, you can do your own barstool research. I'm not going to name the company per se, but I'll name the substance that they were talking about. And this is an additive called, that is, the chemical name is dimethyl dicarbonate. It's something, if you go back last year, we talked about wine additives. It's something that I mentioned in that podcast as well. Definitely give that episode a listen if you're interested in some of the things that can actually go into wine that we don't have to tell you go into wine. And this one is something that many of us in the industry lovingly call the Death Star, because when you shoot it into your wine, it kills everything. It has been used in the wine, not just the wine industry, but the beverage industry, I mean, all over the place since the late 80s. And again, for it's basically spelled exactly how it sounds, dimethyl dicarbonate. You can do your own barstool research if you like. I'm not going to get too much into it here, but you're welcome to go for it. It's a substance that, you know, I'm going to preface this kind of the rest of this episode with this, is that whether or not you're a winemaker and you use this substance, I don't really care. I mean, I do care because it's something that I would never use in my winemaking. And I find it interesting that people feel the need to use it. But that's not really the crux of the issue. It is something that is, it's almost like a, I'm trying to draw an equivalent analogy. It's almost like a Roundup weed killer kind of thing. It just kills everything that you need it or want it to. And theoretically, over X amount of time, it dissipates and it's no longer toxic. It's something that has to be dosed in a very specific way, with very specific, machinery. It's something that is, you know, in its pure form is very toxic, and not good for you. But given X amount of time, it has in essence a half-life and it degrades to a point where it is safe to consume. There's plenty of research done by the company that produces it, saying how safe it actually is. I am someone who is inherently skeptical of research done in-house by large companies because they're a for-profit business. They have every incentive to sell more of this product. So if they're publishing their own research and they're saying, hey, it's great, that's a red flag for me. There was a study done on this particular substance by the EU, I believe it was 2016, maybe 2017. And they did it, you know, this lab test or this study in mice. So take that for what you will. And the EU, for those that don't know, they have far more strict labeling and food ingredient type restrictions than we do here in the good old US of A. So I do take that study with a little bit more heft. But what I was able to garner from it was basically, if you use too high of a dose, the mice get sick. And if you stay within the parameters of what the company states is okay, then the mice are okay. And it was more of a short-term study, not something that's, you know, studying these mice over, you know, a long-term, you know, effect kind of thing. And frankly, if I'm going to really put some weight behind a study, whether it's from the company itself or from an independent body, you know, I want to see the long-term effects of something, of a product such as this. You know, if it's been used in and around the beverage industry as a whole, not just wine, for going on 4 decades now, let's see a 20-year or a 30-year study where people have really gotten into this and said, hey, we've had groups of people who have been consuming these products over the course of this amount of time. We know these products use dimethyl dicarbonate as a fining agent. You know, are there any long-term impacts? That's the kind of stuff that I personally would want to know. There might be a study out there. If any of you happen to know of a study on dimethyl dicarbonate over a 20 or 30 year period, I would love to read it. I was not able to find one. I'm sure there's something out there I missed. So I will plead, you know, a little bit of ignorance in that, as best you can, doing your barstool research at home, you know, you try and do the best you can, I should say. And based on what I was able to find, it wasn't super convincing. But again, everyone can make their own decisions. Now, back to the issue at hand. What is the deal with that additive that was posted? And why doesn't it have to be labeled? So the reason, the labeling stuff is very simple. And this is something that I've talked to quite a few people about, actually over the course of some of our events over the last couple of weeks, but also tastings at the winery. And it's as simple as this. The wine industry is not governed by the FDA. That's the Food and Drug Administration. That's not our governing body. They are not the ones that make the rules for the wine industry. We are governed by the Trade Tax Bureau, the TTB, formerly known as the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms. So it's a completely different government alphabet agency that makes the rules for winemaking. And frankly, they don't care what we use other than sulfites. I mean, they want to know if it contains sulfites and the alcohol percentage, because they're in essence a tax collection agency. They don't care about the ingredients. They're just in essence a revenue generator, my own humble opinion on that, for the federal government. They don't really care how they get their money. They just want to make sure that they get paid on time. And much like their partner in crime, the IRS, as long as you're not hiding money, they might be angry at you, but just don't hide money, right? That's when they get really mad. Don't hide things. Be open. And if you get audited, make sure you're upfront about stuff. But long story short, because we're not governed by the Food and Drug Administration, we don't have to do shit in terms of labeling. The TTB has a handful of requirements. I think there are 9 things that actually have to be on a wine label in some way, shape, or form. Maybe it's 7, but there's very few. And none of that has to be what is actually in that bottle. So, which is a huge point of contention, which is why, I mean, even on our own website, we have a Wine by the Numbers page that we launched earlier this year to basically dive into every single facet of our winemaking, what we use, and more importantly, what we don't use in our winemaking, to try and provide that level of transparency when it comes to, you know, winemaking in general. It's something that I have talked a big game about over the years, and I felt it's high time that we put our money where our mouth is and let people know, like, hey, here's actually what's going into our wines. So the deal with that post wasn't so much the substance, dimethyl dicarbonate. That was not the issue. The issue was, this email came from a well-known lab that sells, you know, this product to wineries. And the issue at hand, regardless of whether or not you think that is a good substance to use or not, That is not the issue here. That we can continue to debate. I'm totally okay with that. The bigger issue is that it's marketed to wineries as something that you do not have to label for your consumers. It's labeled as something, hey, please, this is something that you can hide from your consumer base for marketing purposes that align with your customer perception or whatever the exact wording was. It was, hey, actively use this so that you can actively hide what's going on. And that was the problem. That was my bone to pick. That was my problem. That is what infuriates me about the kind of laissez-faire attitude that wineries and some of these labs have towards what they're putting into their products that are supposed to be these very high quality, very, wine's got this like romantic, luxurious thing. You know, it has that air, it has that vibe. And to be like, hey, let's treat our consumers like mushrooms, feed them shit, keep them in the dark. That kind of attitude sucks. You know, as much as I love that scene from The Departed, it's a great, great scene. You know, that's not something that we should be doing. It's irresponsible. And it's something that frustrates me. I'm very much of the opinion that an informed consumer is a more powerful consumer. And that's something that we should all be embracing in this industry, especially given the fact that many of us are like, it's farming and it's nature and it's meant to be this honest, you know, honestly crafted, you know, product that's sustainable and beautiful and you know, whatever, you know, it's very romantic. And when you're actively omitting things from your process, from, you know, disclosures and what you probably should be letting people know about, that rubs me the wrong way. It just rubs me the wrong way. Again, this isn't about whether or not this substance actually dissipates and is safe. You know, if it is, great. If it's not, that sucks. All research at this stage points to the fact that it is, and this is not that big of an issue. But that's not the problem. The problem is the lack of disclosure and transparency in winemaking today, especially when it comes to, you know, things like this. That's super important. It's something, this is a hill that I will probably die on when it comes to wine and winemaking, because this is something that, and it's something that many of us behind closed doors within the industry talk about, is we talk about how wines are manipulated. We talk about the additives and the extracts. We talk about finding agents such as this, and the fact that it kind of sucks that people don't know. Like, people don't know how much sugar is actually in most commercially made wines. People don't know that things are fined with egg whites and isinglass and animal products. People don't know that dimethyl dicarbonate's a thing within just the beverage industry as a whole. Like, the tricks of the trade are endless. You know, why is it that, you know, reading a bunch of ingredients on like something like Hot Cheetos, which I adore, by the way, is necessary and people ought to know what all those additives and colorings and flavorings and stuff are. But in wine, we can use stuff like that and no one has to know. That is the deal with what I posted. That is the deal with this additive, along with so many others within the wine industry, and why we're trying to actively talk more about it, I think many are trying to be more transparent, and a lot of us are trying to talk that shit and let people know, like, hey, this is what's going on. And if you really care about what you're consuming, these are the questions you should be asking. And if you can't get a straight answer, that should probably tell you everything that you need to know. All right, that has been another episode of the Wind Up Podcast. It is time for me. I gotta go get ready for another wine event. It has been an amazing few road trips. A big shout out again to everyone in Pittsburgh, Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago. It has been just an outrageously fun couple of weeks. Very excited for it to continue here in Columbia. We'll be back actually in St. Louis in the next few days, and again in Kansas City shoot, I'm basically in the last month. I'm spending like 3 weeks in Missouri. It's kind of wild. Misery loves company, as I love to say. Be sure to follow us again on any and all of our social networks, just at MTGA Wines, especially on YouTube, the Book of Face. Instagram is where we do most of our posting, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. You can find us all there. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast, continue sharing it, and do leave a rating or review. That would be excellent of you to help kind of spread the reach of it. I hope you have an amazing rest of your day, and we'll try and get some more content out your way here shortly as the road trips allow. Have a good one.